This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
And today in our 391st episode, we have an interview with Tito and Aline, who are really fascinating science communicators from Brazil with books, videos, and even dinosaur games that they've brought together to teach all sorts of cool stuff about dinosaur science.
Yes, and they're also paleontologists. They're doing it all.
Yeah. We also have Dinosaur of the Day, Stegoceratops, and a fun fact. But before we get into all of that, as always, we like to thank some of our patrons. And this week, we'd like to thank DC Cassundra, Dennis Saltosaurus, English Graham, Jonah, Cezisaurus, Misunderstood Oviraptor, Trent Carbajal, Ellen, Pippaceratops, and Verossaraptor.
Thank you so much to everybody for your support. We say this every week. It means so much to us, and it's how we keep the show going. So thank you for being part of our dinosaur community.
And without further ado, we're going to go on to our interview with Tito and Aline. But as always, we got talking for a long time, and we didn't fit it all into this episode. So if you'd like the unabridged version, the longer extended cut, make sure to head over to the premium content feed that you get through patreon.com/inodino. We're joined this week by Tito Aureliano, a paleontologist, geologist, science communicator, and researcher at the University of Campinas and UFRN, as well as Aline Gilargi, a scientist, science communicator, and professor of paleontology, also at UFRN. Thank you both so much for joining me and Sabrina.
Thank you, Garrett and Sabrina, for the invitation. We are very happy to be here with you.
This podcast is amazing. It's great to be part of one of the episodes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So I know you've both done field work in the outback in Northeast Brazil the past 6 years, which is very exciting to us because usually we talk about the Australian outback, but there's a lot more out there.
The Brazilian outback.
Yeah. Would you mind telling us a little bit about your work and some of your findings so far?
Okay. Usually people think that Brazil is all about Amazon forest, right? But here we have several biomes. So you can find the Cerrado area, which is pretty much like the African savanna. And here in Northeast Brazil, we have something very similar to the Australian outback. So it's a pretty dry region where you have a very specific type of vegetation. That's why it's called the Caatinga, which means the white vegetation. In Northeast Brazil, it's one of the richer regions in fossil sites. Specifically, we are used to work in the Araripe region and in the Vale do Rio do Peixe region. So the Araripe region, people are more used to because since it's a very famous fossil Lagerstätte, where you have the Santana group with the Crato and Romualdo formation, several beautiful fossils, such as Ubirajara, which was recently described. Mm-hmm. And, well, raised some concerns, right? And
Irritator and many spinosaurids and so on. They all come from this area, the pterosaurs.
So this is like in the heart of Brazilian outback. And we also are used to work in the Vale do Rio do Peixe region, where you have a huge mega track site. So several footprints from the late Cretaceous. You can find sauropod tracks, many theropod tracks, all in the middle of the beautiful scenario of the Brazilian outback. Tito, have something to say about that region?
No, I absolutely love it. My ancestry comes from Northeast Brazil, from this area. I grew up in the Midwest, but my whole family come from there. So for me, it's very special to work in this area, you know, because it's my own history that's in there.
Yeah.
So it's a, well, it's a very dry region indeed. And just a bit of curiosity, the cactus that invaded Australia are from Northeast Brazil. So a bit of the outback, of the Australian outback cactus can also be found here in Northeast Brazil.
Yeah, that's interesting. So even more similar biomes than previously.
Yeah, alien species, right?
Is it similar to the Australian outback in that it's pretty like wide open, not a lot of people, not a lot of city development, or is it more developed than the Australian outback?
I think it is much more populated than the Australian outback. I have never been there in Australia, but from what I've seen from Landsat images, Google Earth, and so on, it is very much more populated and a little bit more vegetated. There is a current tendency of desertification there. So the climate's getting progressively drier. That's a problem because historically, all the peasants and cowboys, there is a very strong cowboy culture there. They are very characteristic. They use a different hat from the cowboys of the South and the cowboys from North America. It's a very unique hat. I might Google it. You're going to see it. It looks like an 18th century hat. And many of these people, they lose their cattle because we go there during the dry season. And the cattle dies. So they go to the big cities, they move in crowds. And this is a huge problem for the country to develop this area, to bring water, to bring jobs. So it's a very complicated area. This is why we say people are vulnerable there.
Mm. Yeah, in short, we can say it's more populated than the Australian outback, but it's still not populated as the rest of Brazil, since the dryness of the region brings very harsh conditions to people that live there. So the people that live there, they suffer from famine and, well, things that comes with the harsh conditions of being in the outback, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see many abandoned farms and houses close to the outcrops because people simply can't live there.
So it sounds like field work might be a little difficult to do too.
Definitely it is. Temperatures are very high, so you have to be constantly worried about not dehydrating. You have a specific vegetation there that looks like...
That's awful.
It looks like cat claws. It's just you get stuck in every shrub around the Caatinga area, so it's really hard to work there.
That I think this beech bush, you know, we don't have there in the Sonora Desert, they don't have in Patagonia, they don't have in Africa. That's the worst thing. We always comment when we are watching those survival documentaries that they throw
no
the guys. You never see an episode of someone going into the Brazilian continent. The bush there is awful.
It's like the spines are curved like cat claws and they hurt you. So I used to say that Caatinga loves you so much that you get stuck on it.
And poisonous plants, if you are unaware of that, they are very common. Mm-hmm. If you just pass by the plant and it touches your skin, it burns and itches like hell.
Yeah, so it's hard.
That is hard. Makes me maybe understand why people like the Hell Creek so much, because there's none of that.
Yeah,
totally.
Interesting. So where... are there any specific sites that you've been to that you found something exciting or you really enjoyed for another reason?
I pretty much enjoyed the several sites around the Souza Basin, which is one of the Vale do Rio do Peixe basins there. Since we have some footprints with exceptionally preserved condition, even skin impressions, sometimes filamentous impressions that pretty much look like feathers, and that's awesome. And you also have mud cracks preserved very much like the recent mud cracks. So it's very confusing because you're in a dry region. So full of mud cracks because of the drying of the rivers and lakes in the region. And suddenly you have mud cracks in the rock with dinosaur footprints. So people that live there usually are confused and think that the huge dinosaur footprints were made more recently than they really are. Mm-hmm. So the regional people used to explain those big dinosaur footprints as the rhea, you know, the large ratite bird, as the rhea footprints and the cow footprints. So between the theropods and the ornithopods and sauropod footprints, they have their own taxonomy, you know. It's very interesting. I really like how they figure out to name stuff there. So it's a gorgeous region because of this very large dinosaur tracks. Some tracks have more than 60 individual tracks, so they're long and beautiful. The environment around, it's just gorgeous. And that's my favorite. I'm really interested to know what's the favorite side from Tito.
It's hard for me to pick just one. I love the Sosa context, especially because it's the bottom of the Cretaceous. So we don't have much information about this moment. And there is a local extinction of Ornithischians.
Yeah, you can see it through the stratigraphic
in this part
column.
Of South America. Yeah, at this point. And we can see a connection and faunal equivalence between North Africa and Iberia and even England with Northeast Brazil.
Which
at
is
this time.
Totally different from Southeast and South Brazil, which are very similar to the Argentinian fauna.
Yeah, that's very different. But I like the Araripe Basin, the Cariri part of the outback, because we have many spinosaurids, you have plenty of fossils. Mm-hmm. So if you have low esteem and you have difficulty of finding fossils, you just go to the Romualdo Formation or to the Crato Formation, you will stumble
Guys,
into something.
It's just unbelievable. Usually when the team is very... like not feeling very good for not finding fossils, just take them to the Araripe area because you're gonna just cheer up everybody. Like hundreds of fossils in an hour. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
What can be frustrating is that most of the fossils, since we do not work with fish, we get frustrated because we work with dinosaurs. And this is a coastal marine environment.
Yeah, so it's fish again. Oh, another fish.
If you're lucky, you find a turtle in a year or maybe a pterosaur in 2 years.
But the fish are beautifully preserved, some of them, even with color patterns. If you're lucky, you can find some feathers. So that's awesome, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Many insects, aquatic insects. And it's beautiful because since it's a laminated limestone, it's pretty much like going and seeing each page of a great book. So it's a gorgeous sight.
But my favorite area of the outback is the most uncharted and unreached area. It's the Upper Jurassic, closer to the San Francisco River. I have been there like 3 times for field work. I found fossils of Mausonid, silicans, other fish, lepidotes, like some ichnofossils, but they are very shy. And the problem is, the San Francisco area, it's like the Brazilian Mississippi. It's the equivalent of the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. It's the San Francisco River, but in a very arid landscape with canyons and so on.
Interesting.
And this area specifically has a great potential, but it's very hard and dangerous.
Guys,
together.
It's like the Wild West. I'm not kidding.
We've forgotten to explain that the Brazilian outback, it's like an area that got lost in time. Like we have technology, we have smartphones and so on in town, but the whole structure is feudalistic. It's like medieval. So we have the landowners, you have the churches, You have people that work like samurais and bounty hunters and just like the Wild West.
And unfortunately, you have the drug trafficking there. Yeah. So that's what make it very much like the Wild West. That's
really
dangerous.
And they plant the drugs alongside the Jurassic outcrop in this river. So it's really dangerous. For just an idea, the last time I've been there, there was a gang of 40 bandits riding on horses, assaulting banks.
Yeah, it's
just like in the movies.
Jeez.
But it's like just that region, guys. Don't be scared.
Yeah, that's specifically this area of the outback that it's very isolated.
Okay.
So unfortunately, I always want the hardest thing, you know.
And just to say a beautiful thing of the Brazilian outback, you all are invited to visit the UNESCO Geopark that is right up in their area. So the Araripe Geopark is right there, far away from this Jurassic area Tito just mentioned. And it's really touristic. You can visit, for example, this Araripe, very famous Araripe sites I mentioned, the laminated limestones. And you can visit all these famous sites, and it's just a beautiful region. You all are like really invited to visit.
We really want to go.
When we start traveling again, that's Brazil is one of the countries we want to go see.
Absolutely. We got the recent book by Giuseppe Leonardi about all the trackways up there.
That's great.
That's great.
It sounds awesome.
So you learn a lot about the Vale do Rio do Peixe area.
I did want to ask, you mentioned the tracks that have filaments in them. And I saw that was mentioned, it was either at a talk or a poster at SVP 2021. Yeah. And I couldn't even imagine what that's like. Are they on like the bottom of the track, or are they sort of sticking out to the sides, or how does that look?
No, that's a really interesting structure associated to the track. So you have a pretty unique track where the animal just slows down and slip a bit in one side as it is walking through a very unstable sediment, so muddy area. And suddenly there is this structure that looks like part of the body of the animal just touched the sediment. And this is all filaments.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. It's a concavenator size theropod. Like,
concavenator size, pretty
14
much.
14 feet.
And it's incredible because you can see any filament in the tracks, but suddenly this structure where part of the animal body touched the mud, that's just full of filaments and nothing like plants, nothing like any of this. So you're describing it, and I'm sure that that will be published soon.
That's amazing. That is so cool. I want to see that. That's worth a trip on its own.
Great.
Cool. So you mentioned Ubirajara, which is a huge thing right now. Originally, it was described with interesting feathers, and then later people were like, well, that looks a little weird. Maybe that's not actually how it was described. And we had wondered, well, maybe the reason that it was described maybe and not reviewed as thoroughly as it could have been is because there was so much controversy around the specimen and the fact that it's now housed in Germany, even though there was a law in Brazil in 1990 saying you can't be exporting fossils like this. And there was an even earlier law that basically said the same thing.
Yeah.
What do you guys, I mean, I can assume what your opinion would be, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about Ubirajara.
Okay, before anything, it's very important to note something here, because I know you guys just love dinosaur as we do.
Mm-hmm.
So do you guys remember when the first non-avian dinosaur with feathers was published?
That in the 1990s?
We're not including Archaeopteryx, right? That one's too avian.
Not including Archaeopteryx, right.
I'm thinking...
Is it one of the ones from China?
Ooh, yeah, those are pretty avian. I don't know, there's... The first one I think of is probably the Uteranus, maybe, or a Guanlong, maybe one of those Tyrannosauroids in like the 90s.
What was the first one?
The Compsognathids.
The Compsognathids, yeah. So one of them was Sinosauropteryx, and if I'm not wrong, I gotta check it before I'm saying anything wrong.
I guess it was in 2000 I think or it, 2001.
No, Sinusarctex was in 1996, exactly. Right. So okay. That's what I wanted to know, because Ubirajara left Brazil in 1995. So if it was described when it was found there, it would be the first non-avian dinosaur described with feathers.
Oh.
So it was for 25 years in a German museum in a drawer there waiting for something to happen. So mm-hmm. It will be the first non-avian dinosaurs with feathers to be known from the southern hemisphere. So after 25 years, we finally got a description. And most of the Brazilian paleontological community was very interested in the finding because it's scientifically very important, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even 25 years later, it's the first feathered non-avian feathered dinosaur described for the southern hemisphere. So that's a landmark for us.
Yeah.
But also, we were very amazed because, well, we have the 1942 law that just prohibits fossils from being sold in Brazil. So you can sell fossils, you can collect and sell fossils here. They're considered patrimony of the union.
Mm.
And as patrimony of the union, the Brazil, you need permits to extract and to export it. Then we have the 1990 law that specifically regulates the export permits. So you don't need a specific permit to extract, but a specific permit to export.
Mm.
And you need all holotypes to be back in Brazil. So that's the problem. The holotype is there in Germany. It's not here. Since it's not here, it's against the 1990 law. So everybody that wants to work with Brazilian fossils, they are allowed to. You can even take them out of Brazil. But you gotta just have the right permits and follow some specific rules.
Mm-hmm.
Such, for example, holotypes and other specimens of national interest must be returned to Brazil. And 30% of all other taxa identified at any time also must return to Brazil. Considering that, yes, Ubirajara is not legally in German, according to Brazilian law.
Mm-hmm.
That's why every Brazilian paleontologist was very concerned about the situation. The authors just released in the newspaper supposed permit for exporting, which is not according to Brazilian law. So it does not follow the regulations from our country. It just mentions that two boxes full of fossils left Brazil in the 1995. Doesn't mention how many fossils, could be just 1,000. I don't know. We don't even know if Ubirajara was inside because it doesn't specify which fossils. And it doesn't include the specific permit from the Science and Technology Ministry. So it's wrong. It's the wrong permit. And since the fossil is important, since the fossil could give visibility to the locality, the vulnerable locality where the fossils come from, then many paleontologists started to, well, let people know about Brazilian laws, the importance of fossils being returned to Brazil, and so on. So that's the big controversy. Mm-hmm. And Tito, what do you think about that?
I think people should respect one another better. If you have colleagues from different country and there are strict laws in this country and these people are humans just like you, they are not inferior humans.
Mm-hmm.
So why dehumanize other nations just to steal their patrimony, their natural resources, their scientific resources? We are not in the 19th century, you know, you're in the 21st century. So these things are things of the past. The world developed. We live in a globalized world.
Mm-hmm.
We have thousands of museums and laboratories here in South America now, all in many countries, and Brazil and Argentina, a lot, Peru, a lot.
So for people that don't know, we have more than 800 paleontologists in Brazil actively working with research, either lecture. So
wow.
It's a lot.
I didn't know there were so many.
Yeah,
exactly. And we have more than 70 graduate programs specialized in paleontology.
Awesome.
Besides more than 80 museums with fossils or fossil exhibitions. So we have a lot of things here. So it doesn't stick very good saying, well, you guys don't have Brazilian paleontologists, either you don't have museums or you don't have, well, structure to study those fossils.
Yeah, obviously not true. Yeah.
And that's why we work so much with science communication, because we want not only Brazilians to know about their heritage, their scientists, their science, but also people from abroad, so from other countries, to know what we have here. So that's why we engage so much besides our paleontologist work with science communication.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know you work with science decolonization too.
Exactly. That's very important. And we, as the new generation of paleontologists, must work together to make our field more ethical and to diversify our field, because this only has advantages. So one example, a simple example, if we have cooperation between different countries, we can have better science. So Brazilians know pretty well their own sedimentary basins, their fossils, and so on. So a cooperation between, for example, German scientists and Brazilian scientists studying a great fossil such as Ubirajara will end in a much better science, much better article than it actually was published in.
Oh, yeah. Especially, you're losing all of the people. It's one thing, it's still pretty wrong, but it's one thing when you're talking about a country where there might not be a paleontologist, there are very few, if any, that have paleontologists. But when you're talking about an area like you guys, where you're literally already there all the time studying this stuff, you have a lot of expertise in the area, you have to include, it doesn't make any sense to publish a paper about an animal from that area. You always include the expert on that either animal type, like if you're going to publish on a troodontid, usually you see like Phil Curry or somebody on it who studies a lot of these, but you always get the person from the area too, because they're going to have a lot of information to add. So yeah, you're definitely right. You got to have, not even just from a what's right and wrong ethically standpoint, but what's best for the science. You got to have the local scientists included.
I just love your comment. And I will add more. You said, for example, if you have an area that you don't have local scientists, so why not work to help trained local scientists. So you can also work on that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're really, one of the places we're most excited about are some of these areas in Africa where there aren't a lot of local scientists, but now there are new universities popping up and there's more training going on. And we've been seeing way more fossils come out of those areas. We're seeing new sauropods popping up. And it's amazing. Yeah.
Totally. And I do think that like foreign countries can collaborate in that. So together, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Everything works better when people are collaborating, because different perspectives lead to better results.
Literally.
That's great.
So going back to science communication more specifically, you both have a very popular YouTube channel, Bone Collectors. And I know you do a lot of broadcasts and you talk about paleontology in Portuguese. It's what, the largest channel in Portuguese about paleontology?
Yeah. It started as a blog. Aline created this blog.
Yeah. Remember science blogs, guys? It was part of science blogs.
I think they're still out there.
Like a fossil. They are. They are indeed. So the blog is a fossil now. Well, not to say it's a living fossil, because I still published something. It started as a blog in 2010, and then Tito came in with the audiovisual stuff.
Yeah, I always wanted to work with documentaries and indie movies and so on. And when I was an undergrad, I convinced Aline to document our field work. I was already documenting field work early in the university, doing field work in the Amazonia, in Patagonia. And we decided to start filming all over Brazil where we go. So I guess we were one of the first to do that.
Well, we were. Awesome. Fossils right now.
Yeah. but it worked. Year after year, the channel grew up and transformed it into a small studio. Mm-hmm. And now we even work with video games, with support from Microsoft, for example.
Mm. Oh, cool. Yeah, we saw, I recently bought Dino Hazard, the game. I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but it looks really cool. And I was wondering how on earth you guys figured out how to make a video game that looks so well polished. Especially, you know, like I don't think either of you.
What are you saying?
What I'm saying is I don't think either of you guys studied how to build games, but like going from paleontology to game design.
That's what we did during vacation.
It's insane. It's insane, actually.
It's insanely difficult.
The game is still in early access. I work it every 1 week in every month. I have week cycles, like 1 week for research, 1 week for science communication, and 1 week for the game, another week to work on different things.
That's
looks
an awesome
great,
idea.
But don't you look at the code, right?
Yes. Yes, it's insane. Sometimes I think, how do I change so dramatically from one subject to another? But it's necessary, and I always had this passion for video games. Mm. And literature and science fiction. Like Jurassic Park influenced me and many other films and books and
games.
In
other words, we are video game nerds.
Yes.
So
we are very nerds, but nerds that like adventure and going into the field for real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We were in this game thing before creating video games. So since we are used to give classes, we use RPG in the classes and the paleontology classes in the undergraduate courses.
Like tabletop RPGs.
Tabletop RPGs. So we travel with the students throughout the geological time to understand better how creatures were in the past and so on.
When you started it as a tabletop game, were you're like playing as a scientist and trying to like solve puzzles with dinosaurs? Is that sort of the format?
So in the tabletop RPG, the students are time travelers. We call them chrononauts. So they travel in time, right? And they work for an enterprise from the future that is like mining the deep time to explore minerals, to explore oil, gas, and to
get
information about the biological life forms.
And to throw nuclear garbage also.
Yeah, throw in deep time. And for the pharmacy industry, to get new medicine and so on, using ancient life. And the main objective of the students is going back in time to collect the specific assets. It could be, for example, to collect, an anomalocaris or an baby T-Rex, whatever, that is maybe important for the company, or to understand some geological aspects of the past, because we give classes to biological sciences students and also to geoscientists. So we have geology students, geophysicists, and so it depends. And that's the whole idea behind the tabletop RPG, which is going to be released, the book. So people that want to play also will be possible to acquire the book and play the tabletop RPG.
Cool.
But then Tito Dino Hazard game has a different framework.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's my RPG. It's more like a JRPG. I really worked on the structure of Chrono Trigger and Earthbound with several elements on many games, many Zelda games. And
takes place in the beginning of the company, right?
Yeah.
When the company was like understanding how to time travel.
Yeah, there is a whole universe there that connects between
the tabletop RPG,
the
book,
comics, and the game. So, yeah, it's a full story, and there is a timeline. It's growing, you know, it's expanding in every release. So I guess people will love it. We are internationalizing now with English publications.
So, yeah, the game is already in English, but if guys are interested about the story background, there is the book, which is English too, but the warning, it's not localized English, so it may be confusing for some yet. But you can read and understanding that is not localized specifically and enjoy the great story behind the game.
For our listeners, then, if they want to find out more about both of you and your work, where's the best place that they can go online?
Okay, we have this website, but if I say it is in Portuguese, so it's hard. colecionadoresdeossos.com. If you go there, there is an English translation there. Just turn on and you have our blogs. We have our history, our agenda. Yeah, you have everything about us.
Yeah, papers we're publishing.
Papers and so on. There is also the Alinis Lab website.
DinoLab. So we are working here in the Diversity, Ethnology, and Osteohistology Lab. So DinoLab. And we can find this on the website dinolab.com.br. So you can access all of our last papers and media conferences and so on.
Amazing.
And you can also find us in every social media, both the Bone Collectors and Colecionadores de Ossos and our names.
Yeah, we are pretty much active on Twitter. So if you're tweeting around, just follow at Alini M. Ghilardi and at Tito.Aureliano, and you can find us.
Awesome.
Great. We'll include all those links in our show notes.
Yeah, so definitely.
People can easily find them.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. That was amazing. And I feel like we only scratched the surface of all your work, but it was great to hear about all the breadth of things that you're working on and maybe some of the stuff that's coming up too.
Again,
yes,
we love your podcast and your work is just amazing. And we want really to invite you to come here and visit our lab and things we are doing. And everyone that are listening to us right now, come visit Brazil and know more about Brazilian dinosaurs, Brazilian paleontology. We have a ton of very cool stuff just popping out in Brazilian paleontologists. And, well, we wait for you on our social medias.
If you ever want to talk about paleohistology as well, and people don't like to talk much about this.
I like paleontology.
Oh, wait, yeah,
it's
we
not
do.
Popular. Yeah.
Oh, we've missed an entire topic.
If you want to talk about paleohistology, just reach out, Tito.
Yeah, I love it. I'm passionate about it.
Awesome.
Guys, thank you again.
Thank you so much again, Tito and Aline. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. And I can't wait until one day we can visit Brazil and see all these amazing fossils.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those stories were amazing. And it sounds like a really cool place to do paleontology. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Conglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures. Which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is, if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners, and you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Stegoceratops, which, if you recognize the name, you might know it's not quite a true dinosaur. This was actually a hybrid dinosaur from Jurassic World. Jurassic World Dominion is coming out soon, so we're covering a lot of the dinosaurs we hadn't yet covered that appear in the films and the books.
Yeah, first when I read it, I thought it was Stegoceras, which is a real dinosaur. It's a pachycephalosaurid. But this is not Stegoceras. Stegoceratops is the make-believe one.
Yes. So this one is a hybrid of Triceratops and Stegosaurus, as well as some sort of beetle, some sort of snake, and cuttlefish.
Because they just work those in, like, for...
for the extra superpowers kind of things that it can do.
Like it's poisonous or something, so it needs to be a snake, and it can camouflage, so it needs to be a cuttlefish. Those are just my guesses.
It's close. One of those was definitely right. So it's got this Triceratops head with a frill and horns, though it's got longer brow horns than a Triceratops, and plates like Stegosaurus on its back and Thagomizers on the tail. So it looks pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I had a little book as a kid where you could flip pages and you'd change the abdomen, the tail, and the head of different animals. And I feel like that's what everybody does with the dinosaurs. It's like, what if you had the spikes of a stegosaur and the plates of a stegosaur, but with the horns of a triceratops? Imagine how defensive and amazing that dinosaur would be.
I think you made something similar in the Jurassic Lego game.
Oh, yeah. In that one, it was because you got like the added features. Like, you could smash through certain twinkly blocks if you have the Triceratops head versus the other body parts.
You made it really shiny, too, because it could do extra stuff when it was shiny.
I think that I gave that one raptor legs, too, so it could, like, jump extra high.
Yeah.
Just to make it extra ridiculous.
So Stegoceratops, sometimes it's seen with a nasal horn, but sometimes it's seen with a nasal boss instead. Just kind of depends on the depiction.
Sometimes it's like a pachyrhinosaurus. Like a stegorhinosaurus.
So again, it's a hybrid dinosaur. It's briefly seen on a computer screen in Jurassic World. It was designed by Henry Wu, but it's unclear if it actually got created in the movies. So you might have to just create your own in that Lego game. It was going to be in Sector 5 on Isla Nublar in Jurassic World, but that part got cut from the plot. The plan, though, was to reveal that Wu was making more hybrids than just Indominus, but Colin Trevorrow's son suggested taking it out to make Indominus Rex stand out more.
I agree with Colin Trevorrow's son. Indominus Rex was enough of hybrid dinosaurs. Even, I mean, they could have taken that out, too, but I guess...
Oh, that was a big part of the movie.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of the hybrid dinosaurs. I'd say the less, the merrier.
But then Rexy got to save the day.
Yeah. I suppose. It could have saved the day from all sorts of other different... It could have made it a Giganotosaurus or something.
Yeah, we'll just see what happens with Rexy in Dominion.
Yeah.
So the name Stegoceratops means roofed horned face. Makes sense. Yeah. Stego from Stegosaurus and Ceratops from Triceratops. It's estimated to be about 30 to 33 feet or 9 to 10 meters long and weigh 11 to 15 tons. And it had a large beak. It may have had exoskeletal armor from its beetle elements. It may have been able to see infrared from its snake elements. And it may have been able to camouflage from its cuttlefish elements, which is the one you got right, Garrett.
I see. So seeing infrared was the snake thing.
Yeah, not venom.
Yeah.
It also may have elements of a flatfish to extract oxygen from water and jellyfish to be bioluminescent. And that's based on these two animals being depicted as computer renderings next to Stegoceratops.
So they gave it gills.
Maybe. It's unclear.
That's so weird.
Its front feet had 5 toes each, and then the back feet had 3 toes each.
So I guess they're going with a Stegosaurus hind leg then, because Triceratops has at least 4 toes.
Yes. Well, if you look at a picture of this, it looks exactly half Triceratops in the front half and half Stegosaurus in the back.
How many hand or front leg toes did you say it had?
5.
Okay, yeah, the same as Triceratops.
You can see Stegoceratops in Jurassic World, the game. I guess you have to fuse level 40 Stegosaurus and level 40 Triceratops to get it. It's also in Jurassic World Evolution. It likes to eat rotten wood, but it also eats horsetails and palms. And in the game, it's part of herds of 3 to 8 Stegoceratops. And it makes cattle and groaning sounds in the game.
They always make everything a cow. Everything that eats plants is just a cow, especially the big stuff.
Also in the game, Stegoceratops can run through a Ceratosaurus with one of its horns and kill it.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty powerful.
Seems like if Stegoceratops could do that, they could just have Triceratops do it as well.
Yeah, maybe you can. I haven't played that game. Oh, and it's in LEGO Jurassic World The Indominus Escape. It's one of the dinosaurs that helps Owen Grady and Claire Deering corral Indominus Rex, which I don't remember. We'll have to rewatch that.
Yeah, interesting.
And there are, of course, Stegoceratops toys.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to mention when you said that it was originally going to be in a movie, because I heard about that we found out about these toys that were being released with one of the Jurassic World movies, and it included Stegoceratops, and everyone was like, oh no, look at, they're finally doing the crazy stuff. But then it turned out not to be in the movie. I guess that was a later change.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, now we've covered another one of the hybrids from the movies, and we'll be covering a few more dinosaurs that appear in the films and books in upcoming episodes.
And our fun fact of the day is one that I've been thinking about covering for a long time, but
you mentioned it's a crazy fun fact.
It is really amazing. I wanted to have enough time to sort of digest it and read about it and some of the other foundational research which had been done about it. So the fact, simply put, is that dinosaurs can communicate through their eggshells with their siblings before hatching.
What?
So you could think of it as like eggs communicating with each other, but really it's not the eggs communicating, it's the embryos inside the eggs that are communicating with the other embryos.
How do we know that?
It's really amazing. So one of the first studies, or one of the earlier studies than this one, was about baby turtles synchronizing their behavior with vibrations.
Hmm.
So what they found is, one of the studies, there's been several studies of turtles, is that these pig-nosed turtles, which are very aptly named, they have what looks sort of like a pig snout on the end of their head. They're pretty cute, actually. So those pig-nosed turtles can hatch really rapidly if nests flood, because they would drown if the eggs stayed underwater for a long time. Hard-shelled reptiles in terrestrial nests need to exchange air through the eggshell so they don't suffocate. It's literally a boundary. And then sometimes there's a little air cell inside that exchanges the air between inside the egg and outside of the egg. So it is really important that they have oxygen available, even if they're buried.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have that oxygen available. And if they get completely covered in water, obviously that can't happen. So what they can do is, if they get covered in water, they can quickly hatch and then swim up to the surface or dig up to the surface in order to get air. So we've known that for a little while. Later on, we realized that what's really happening with these pig-nosed turtles is that, in addition to responding to a lack of oxygen, they can also respond to a vibration response. So if there's a certain type of vibration going on, then that will trigger them to hatch and get out of there quickly as well.
Hmm.
So it's possible that that initial response is from thunder. They're like thunder buddies in that movie, Ted.
I do.
They all work together to protect each other from thunder. or from increased heart rates, because if the oxygen level drops, the heart rate can increase, and then that might cause some kind of vibration. Those are sort of edge hypotheses. Probably more likely is that one of the eggs notices that there is a reduction in oxygen and starts vibrating, and that vibration is communicated to the other eggs, and they sort of spread the message by all starting to vibrate, and then they all get out as a group. And that what they've found is that these eggs will hatch faster if you put a group of them together and reduce the amount of oxygen available, or you stimulate one of them with a vibration. They'll all start to vibrate, and then they get out a lot quicker than if you just do it one-on-one.
Interesting.
So there's this like group benefit that they get by being together and communicating like, uh-oh, something's going on. Oh yeah, I think something's going on too. We got to get out of here. Than if they're just trying to figure out on their own. Interestingly, there's also a frog that hatches, and it hatches early if a snake is attacking a clutch of eggs. They can actually detect the specific vibrations of the snake coming into the nest, and then they hatch so they can get out of the eggs that the snake is trying to eat.
It's a danger alert.
It is, but it's really amazing because those embryos aren't just responding to any vibration to hatch early, because they can differentiate the vibrations from that snake versus the vibrations from wind or the vibrations from rain on a nest. Mm-hmm. So they're very sensitive and intelligent about what kind of vibration triggers them to have this behavior. Because you don't want to hatch early. You're better off staying in the egg and developing more.
Right. But unless you're about to get eaten.
Exactly.
Then you need to get out.
Then it's a good time to hatch. So we know that these turtles can hatch early. And there have been similar studies with crocodilians, too, that they can communicate by vibrating and sort of encourage each other to hatch. So scientists have also previously studied bird embryos in clutches together and found that some birds make clicking noises when they're getting ready to hatch, possibly to coordinate their hatching, because they are laid, you know, birds only have the one ovary and they can only lay one egg a day, basically at most. So it takes a few days to lay a whole clutch of eggs, and then they might want to coordinate when they're going to hatch, or just communicate a little bit about when this hatching is happening can be beneficial for them. So some of them can click, others make vocalizations that can be heard through the eggshell, sort of like they're just chirping or something through the eggshell and the other birds can hear it. And they found that eggs don't hatch as quickly if they're isolated, so they seem to be using those sounds to coordinate hatching in other bird cases. But the most impressive study, I think, is this new one. It's not really that new anymore. It was published, I think, in 2019 in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. And it was written by Jose Noguera and Alberto Valando. And what they were doing is looking at how embryos might recognize predator warning calls from adults.
Oh, wow.
So
it's a whole nother level.
Yeah. So it's not just a response to a direct stimulus to the egg, like one of them detects a vibration and tells the other ones, or one of them detects that there's low oxygen and tells the other ones. This one, sometimes what we've seen is that an older embryo inside a nest can actually hear a vocalization from its parent outside of the nest or from another animal from the same species, a warning call, for example, and respond to that. So they were studying yellow-legged gulls, which is a seagull in Europe and North Africa. It literally just looks like a regular seagull, but they are amazing. And they wanted to test if those gull eggs, or the embryos inside the eggs, I should say, could transmit information between the embryos within a clutch of eggs that they received from a parent. So it's like, can they communicate? Can they get through the grapevine, you know, like play the game of telephone of that gossiping information? Like, can they do that as embryos? This is really relevant because these gull embryos can hear starting at around 21 days old. They hatch at about 28 days old, but the eggs are laid about 2 days apart. So the younger chicks in a clutch might not get the message from the adults if, say, the adults are doing a warning call and the oldest one is old enough to hear it, but the younger ones can't yet hear it. If they're communicating that message for a few days, then that can get passed along to the younger ones. Or it's just possible that one of them can't hear as well, and maybe it can get a message differently from the egg than it can't get from the adult. So what they did was they went out into the fields and they found these nesting sites of the yellow-legged gulls, and then they took some of the eggs out of the nest, out of various nests, and they put him in a little soundproof box, and then they played a warning call, simulate, you know, just through a speaker in that box for the eggs to hear. And they actually noticed that those eggs began vibrating at pretty specific frequencies. And then they put those eggs back into nests just to see what would happen. And what they found is that after reintroducing those vibrating eggs into the nest, the siblings also began vibrating, spreading that information throughout the nest. So they're all vibrating to let each other know, uh-oh, mama bird is doing a warning call. I didn't hear it, but the other egg told me that it's happening, so I'm letting you know. And it spreads all the way through until they're all vibrating. They all know that this warning has been given by the adults. The really crazy thing about it is that when they analyzed these embryos, and really when they analyzed the chicks after they hatched, they found significant changes in both the gene expression in like what DNA was actually expressed, like what genes are being expressed in the chicks, so like physical changes in them, as well as their behavior. So compared to chicks that hadn't heard warning calls from parents or siblings, just like other ones randomly throughout that nesting site, they found that the exposed chicks had higher levels of corticosterone, which is a stress hormone.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprising if you're in an embryo in a super vulnerable state.
Yes.
And there's warning calls going off, you might be a little stressed. They also incubated longer by about a day. But the biggest effects were actually behavioral. So they vocalized much less after they were hatched, about twice a minute for a normal unexposed egg,
mm-hmm,
or chick, I should say, versus less than once a minute for one of these eggs that was warned about predators being around.
If you're quieter, maybe the predator won't hear you.
Exactly, yes. They also crouched much faster after hearing a warning call from a parent now that they're hatched.
Hmm.
So that is something that all of the chicks will do. If they hear a warning call, they know instinctively to crouch down. But in ones that weren't exposed to the warning calls as a chick, it took them about 20 seconds for them to squat down, whereas it took less than 10 seconds for the eggs that were exposed. But this also applied not just to the ones that had heard the warning call, but to the ones that got the message from the vibration from the other one. So it's not just like, oh, I recognize that sound from when I was an embryo. It's something more innate.
It is deep in their bones.
It really is. They're getting this message. It's crazy. Another interesting one was they had a shorter tarsus by a few percent, which is the lower part of the leg and actually a lot of the leg in terms of height. The researchers didn't offer an explanation of why that might be, but I think presumably it's to help them hide better in a nest because their main defense is crouching. If they're also shorter in the first place, then that would make them less vulnerable. So to summarize, these dinosaurs have some amazing ability to communicate even while they're still embryos, and they can actually change what they're going to be like when they hatch if they get warned about predators, even within a week of their hatching. Because remember, they can't get the message, or at least some of them didn't get the message, until they were 21 days old, and they hatch at 28 days, and yet they still are...
It changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really cool, too, because the changes actually go forward. So that tarsus development, wasn't that different when they hatched, but at a difference between a one-day-old chick and a five-day-old chick, the five-day-old chicks of the group that were exposed to the warning calls or exposed to eggs that were exposed to warning calls all had the shorter legs.
Wow.
So it was changing the way, that was the thing about the DNA. When they looked at the DNA, they could tell that there were changes in different genes being expressed. Some of those related to the height of the chick development after they hatched.
That is a crazy fun fact.
It is. So it's basically like this adjustable feature that these dinosaurs have in responding to whether or not there are raiding predators present when they're going to hatch. And the reason that's really useful is because, at least in this case, for the yellow-legged gulls, the main predator that comes after them are minks, and the minks aren't always there. So when the minks aren't there, it's better to have longer legs, presumably, and to make noises so the parents remember you and bring you food and all that kind of stuff, and to stay upright so the parents can see you, and, you know, crouching down isn't super important. But when there are minks around, it all reverses, right? It's better to be quiet. It's better to get down quickly. It's better to be shorter. And they can actually make that change by hearing from their parents that there are minks around while they're in an embryo. And they could spread that message between each other, including to ones that couldn't hear yet. So it's just, It's so cool. And I can't even imagine all the situations this could have been useful in the Mesozoic. Like, you've got little sauropods, and they can feel the footsteps of a tyrannosaur or you know, a giganotosaurus or something. And those
now
vibrations.
Now is the time to run.
Yeah. Or stay in the egg, because he's actually stayed in the egg for like a day longer, too.
Oh, yeah.
So it could be like, you know, everybody wait.
Hide in place.
Yeah. Or it could be, you know, like developing different muscles to like run faster or grow faster, or who knows what sort of changes could be planned for if you know as an embryo that this world you're going into has a specific predator around.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thank you again for listening, and if you haven't yet already, consider joining our community on patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.